Do you know that the average product bought online is dropped 17 times before delivery because of the large number of people involved in the logistics chain? No wonder robust packaging is necessary for e-commerce. And this need, together with rapid growth in this sector, is driving stellar forecasts for linear low-density polyethylene demand growth globally. I'm Will Beacham, and also in this week's Think Tank podcast, how will demographic trends drive demand for chemicals in the long term? And one of our favourite topics, chemical supply chains. We will get some perspectives from the Gulf Petrochemical Association. With me to discuss these topics, we have our usual panel of experts, Nigel Davis, ICIS Insight Editor, Paul Hodges, Chairman of New Normal Consulting, and John Richardson, our Senior Consultant in Asia. John, let's start with you. Could you give us a bit more detail about what's driving these optimistic forecasts for LLDPE demand growth that you've picked out of the supply and demand database?
Well, it's to do with the growth of online sales during the pandemic and how they could have become entrenched in people's buying habits. If you go back to what happened in China, there was a brief economic downturn in 2015. And then suddenly people were buying high-end restaurant food delivered to their homes. And that led to an explosion of new services that made, you know, online delivery generally more convenient of groceries, not just food. And it's become entrenched in their buying patterns. And it's a question of whether that will now work in the Western world. Here in Australia, even though lockdowns have been eased for about a year now across most of Australia, Victoria being the exception, the online sales are really becoming embedded in the way people buy much more than before the pandemic. And the issue then is the amount of packaging, which initially will go into those online sales. You've got, you know, bubble wrap, shrink and stretch film made from linear low. So you can draw a scenario. If you combine that with extra, you know, increased hygiene needs as well, which I think the precautionary principle will mean will still mean a lot of hygiene products for a long time, even if we get on top of the pandemic. You can draw a scenario where you have very strong demand growth. I mean, last year, it looked, everyone thought it was going to be doom and gloom. And this is back in April. We're looking at negative growth. You look historically, linear low fell by 60% in the US in 2008. In Europe, it was down 3% in 2008, 10% the following year. But if you look at last year, it's probably grew around 5% globally, about the same as 2019 over 2018. So, you know, it was a good year. Europe was positive, US was positive, the developing world was negative, but China grew by 13%, 14%. So, you know, there's something around online packaging. There's a lot to do with hygiene, where you can draw a scenario that will carry on for the next few years. And also, it's crucial as well to note that China can't upset the apple cart, because looking at our data, even if you increase the operating rates beyond our base case and add the unconfirmed capacity, China cannot get anywhere near self-sufficiency in linear low by 2031. It just hasn't got enough projects on the ground at the moment, that might change, to really boost its self-sufficiency. So you have strong demand growth and not that supply threat from China, which you have in polypropylene. Big time in polypropylene. Some of the sort of, you know, the polypropylene is really going to struggle because of the supply side from China. So for linear low, it looks quite good. Having said that, the sustainability issues are enormous. It's a reputation issue for the industry that, you know, that the fact that they use so much plastic, if you talk to anybody who buys anything online, the amount of plastic that's used, as you say, it's dropped 17 times. So people put so much packaging into internet sales that it's a problem for the industry because it's going to get noticed. You know, the sustainability issue, how do we dispose of, how do we collect all this plastic waste, how do we recycle it? But certainly in the short term, you know, you could draw a scenario where there's no linear low density polyethylene downside the next few years anyway.
So it looks like a kind of a bit of a bright spot on polyethylene. Do you think that there will be a requirement for projects for expansions, particularly in LLDPE rather than other polymers?
Possibly, but I think this recycling pressure is going to build and build, as it becomes more and more evident the amount of, plastic that's being used in internet sales. So the collection issue for me is a big thing. Where's all this waste going to go? I'm just thinking the developing world, as internet sales grow in the developing world, all the packaging, how are you going to collect that waste? What are you going to do with it? This is a real problem. But yes, certainly, I think there's an opportunity. I mean, I think China will be looking at the balances and saying, oh, okay, we're building lots of HDPE projects. Why don't we build more linear low? They may push harder on the projects, quite a lot harder on the projects over the next few years.
Thanks, John. Well, Paul and John, when I was a young cub reporter on European Chemical News, you both published a book called Boom, Gloom and the New Normal: How Western Baby Boomers Are Changing Global Demand Patterns Again. And you realised back then, 10 years ago, how important demographic trends are for chemicals demand. And now, with China last week abandoning its two-child policy, it looks like the politicians are also waking up to the impact. We read more and more about it in the news, and it seems to be moving up the chemical industry agenda. It's getting noticed. Paul, could you explain how demographics are gradually shaping and influencing chemicals demand?
Certainly, yes. I mean, we're glad, I think, John and I, that we brought your career to such a peak, Will.
Thank you.
It's one of the great achievements of our time. Obviously, there was a lot of talent there already, but really, no, it was great that ISIS published the book, and it's still available on Kindle for a very, very reasonable fee, about 3 cents, I think, or something now. The story is really very simple, and I suppose that over the last 10 years, John and I have just continued to be astonished by the fact that what is a very simple, very obvious story, which anyone should really be able to understand, has just been ignored by policymakers. And really, we've had some quite abusive stuff from some of the senior policymakers about we don't know what we're talking about and so on. But after 10 years, it's now becoming pretty clear that we did know what we were talking about. And it is a very simple story. In 1950, you had 2.5 billion people in the world. And then you had the greatest baby boom in history. In the States, for example, in the next 18 years, you had a 52% increase in the number of babies being born than in the previous 18 years. And you had that right across. We have data, we don't have a lot of data for outside the G7, but the G7 main economies, which are 60% of the world, we have good data going back to the First World War. So you saw this vast increase in the number of babies. In the 1946 to 1970 period, across the G7, you had 10.1 million babies being born. And then from 1970, you stopped having babies being born because life expectancy was increasing and you no longer retired at the age of 65, got your gold watch, played a round of golf or a round of game or something, and died. You carried on living. And so a new generation was formed of what we call perennials, the over 55s. Never ever existed in the past. 250 years ago, before smallpox injection came in, people died at 40. They died at 30 in the developing world. So you suddenly get up to 80, you've doubled life expectancy, you have a new generation. Does this matter? Of course it matters. Because when you're young, when you're under 25, you are demand. You don't do very much at all. 25 to 54, you are, all the data shows you this, that you are now consuming a lot because you go into your job, you build your career, you need stuff, you need to buy a car, you might need to buy a house, you might have settled down and have a family, you have kids, as we all know, they never stop wanting stuff and needing stuff and so on. So 25 to 54, the wealth creators, you have unbelievable demand. And if you're going from 2.5 billion people then in 1950 to 7.8 billion today, it is impossible not to have growth. This is nothing to do with central banks being independent or anything else. tell me how you could possibly, in any world you would imagine, get no growth if your population is trebling over that period. But now, since 2000, all these boomers who were creating all this demand have now moved into the perennial, okay? And they are a replacement economy because they already own most of what they need. They might need, you know, a sofa might break or something during lockdown, so you might need a new one. So they don't drive to work anymore because they're retired. They don't drive their kids to school or to parties or to whatever, sport or whatever, because they're not having kids anymore. So the whole pattern of life changes. And that's it. Now, you know, John and I have talked to audiences all around the world, and I can tell you, probably 500 presentations, nobody has ever said to me, well, there's a flaw in your argument, except when I sit down with central bankers who say, oh, no, you don't understand. And I say, what is there not to understand? But that's what they say. And so we've had 20 years where people have refused to face the obvious. But now, finally, as you said, John and I are being proved right.
And you described the drag on demand really well, and populations are aging around the world, but yet chemical demand is still growing. It's still going from strength to strength. So how do you explain that?
Oh, because we're going back at the same time, but we're not going back to where we were. We're going back in a new way. So if you look 60 years ago, before I joined the industry, the industry took this visionary step of moving away from coal to use oil and gas as a feedstock. And it was fantastically successful. And, you know, you saw with polyester replacing cotton, PET replacing glass, plastic replacing, you know, nothing in many cases, just improving and so on. So we came out with products that were valuable and took market share in many cases. Now, is there any reason why that should stop? No. And the great thing about the positioning today is that we move away, however, from a simple multiple of GDP, because GDP now isn't relevant because it's, you know, we're talking about an aging population. So it's not the same thing. We can't just say, oh, well, they're all going to, all the 25-year-olds will be 30 next week, so they'll need more of this. It doesn't go linear anymore. But that doesn't matter, because you can replace fossil fuels. And you're going to do that over the next 5 or 10 years. So fossil fuels are gone. You're going to have abundant energy. You can already buy electricity now in many countries for 1 cent a kilowatt hour. So you don't need, and electric vehicles will run on that kind of cost. So you don't need fossil fuels anymore. Fine. But you can't allow the carbon in plastic to be thrown away anymore, because that carbon will get into the atmosphere and that will destroy any chance you've got of meeting your CO2 targets to get to net zero. So you have to keep that plastic in. Ah, you say, isn't this fantastic? I mean, we just heard John talking eloquently about plastics and internet packaging and so on. All you have to do is to set up proper collection systems and collect that recycled plastic, so you keep the carbon in the plastic and you turn it back into usable products. Now, this is not really rocket science. It simply requires a change of mindset at the top of the industry. And I, you know, to be honest, I'm very encouraged. You can see this. I was, you know, an expert advisor to the World Economic Forum's CEO Build Back Better team in the summer. All those CEOs got it, you know, and you can see the petrochemicals Europe has got it, CEFIC has got it. I think the Americans are now getting it with Trump gone. You know, common sense is coming back in there. So I think we're at the start of a real golden age here. We won't be using fossil fuels. You know, all those legacy crackers and so on will disappear. We'll move to a much more local, carbon friendly system. But we do need plastics. We do need chemicals because they are so much better than their alternatives, or indeed not having an alternative.
Thanks, Paul. John, you published some demand growth graphs last week, which forecast over 1 billion tonnes of polyethylene demand growth in emerging economies over the next 10 years. So I'm just wondering, how do these demographic trends apply to emerging economies? Is it different to mature economies?
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got tremendous demographic dividends in Africa, in India, in poorer parts of Southeast Asia. I mean, in Niger, for example, the median age is extraordinarily 15. Middle East, it's Saudi, it's 27. And you've also got the fact that per capita levels of polymer consumption are very low, and people don't have the basic stuff. Stuff that we take for granted. And there's no doubt that, you know, the plastic packaging is enormously important. It's a life enhancer. It improves your quality of life, but it's a lifesaver in terms of all the stuff that goes in syringes, blood bags, hospital gowns that are disposable, face masks, all the medical equipment that's made from polymers. And then you've got plastic film that preserves food. The biggest problems in the developing world is not necessarily always food supply, it's getting food to people fresh so they can consume it. So, you know, by the very means of people getting wealthier in the developing world, there'll be a huge increase in polymers demand. How we meet that demand is a different question. And you've got youthful populations. So, you know, this is why you see this enormous growth over the next 10 years in the developing world, if you also include China. Now, China is a very interesting case because it's not a fully developed country yet, but I wouldn't classify it as a standard developing country. It's got some extremely wealthy provinces and some very rich people, but it's still got a very low per capita income level as a whole. So their challenge is different. I mean, the challenge of the developing world is how do you create enough jobs for all those babies, all those young people? How in Niger do you create enough jobs for the 15-year-olds? How you do that in India is a massive challenge. Potentially, there's a lot of growth there. In China, is how they compensate for demographics that they're not going to be able to reverse, I don't think. It's extremely difficult. You've got entrenched social habits now of really low birth rates per mother, number of children per mother, 1.3 or whatever it is, really, really low, below replacement rate. So what's China going to do? Well, its economy might be okay if it can outsource some of its manufacturing, its low-value manufacturing to the developing world. We're seeing that. If it can get lots of cheap resources to support its economy, lots of cheap oil and gas with deals with the Belt and Road Initiative member countries, if you can do that. In petrochemicals, it's about getting cheap supplies of petrochemicals, either from its partners in the developing world and the developed world, you know, places like South Korea, and also building lots of its own petrochemical capacity to get, you know, cheap sources of raw material. And also the petrochemical business, as they go into higher value polymers, moving up the value chain, justifying those higher wages. So it's two things, really. It's outsourcing low-value manufacturing overseas, getting cheap raw materials. And, you know, this big clash with the United States is down to demographics. They have to move up the manufacturing value chain. They must get access to higher value technologies in their domestic industries to justify those higher wages, because the working age population is shrinking. At a time when the US is treating China as an adversary. So you've got a clash here. Demographics driving geopolitics. And then in the Middle East, you've got a youthful population trying to create jobs for all those young people. Sustainability meets demographics because of declining oil demand. So it's complicated, Will. I mean, you know, the demand picture is complicated. Certainly in aging societies, you've got a demand drag from demographics, absolutely. But in the developing world, it's different. And in China, it's how they compensate for the aging population. You know, can they do it? Can they maintain their spectacular economic growth over the next 20 years? There's some major challenges for them, but they can do it. They can compensate for the demographics.
Oh, Paul and John, thanks for that update on demographics. Now, Nigel, you listened in to the Gulf Petrochemical Association's supply chain conference last week and heard a keynote speech by the chairman of Kuwait PIC. What advice did he give the industry as it tries to make chemical supply chains more robust?
Well, we heard some very wise words from Mr. Hamad Al-Turkat last week, Will, at the GPCA Online Supply Chain Conference. Of course, you know, we can make the stuff, but we've got to be able to deliver it. And as he said, it's easy to sell, but hard to deliver. And I mean, no more so than during the pandemic. You know, although chemical industries were designated as being essential industries, we still needed to get the product to the customer. And we've seen all sorts of problems with supply chains. We know, for instance, that container freight costs have gone back up again in the past few days, I believe, having come down from ridiculously high levels. And of course, just getting a container is difficult enough. Moving stuff around the world has become increasingly difficult. Now, I mean, Mr. Al-Turkat was, as I said, was pointing to the fact that, you know, this is a senior management issue, really, now. And senior management has to get a grip, has to understand what the supply chain really means for the company. How do we actually deliver material to our customers? How do we deal with those customers on a day-to-day basis? One of his suggestions was quite interesting. He said, "Well, you know, surprise your supply chain people. Actually, go and review them, evaluate them with your customers. You know, as a surprise, almost go in there and just see what's happening. Try and get to dig into the entrails, as it were, and to the bones of the matter, and find out what's going on. And what does the company need in future?" I mean, I was thinking more about, you know, what does this mean in terms of costs? Going forward, do companies have to build more cost into their supply chain? And what does that mean for the rest of the company? Do they have to perhaps try and save costs elsewhere to be able to maintain a robust supply chain and a robust delivery service? And also, you need flexibility. So do we go to regional hubs? Do you want strategically located warehouses, for example, to deliver to major customers, particularly if you're talking about delivering from a location such as the Middle East out to markets in the developing world, particularly. We've been talking about that today, of course. And, you know, as I said, scenarios, actually building perhaps more cost into that, but having alternatives as well. Because, okay, the pandemic, I mean, we really hope is a sort of a unique event, but there's nothing to suggest that something else might come along in the next 10 or more years that will again disrupt global supply chains and put enormous pressure back onto this part of the chemical industry.
And are there any signs of easing in all the supply chain chaos that we've been experiencing? And that it was really interesting to see how that price of containers, shifting containers from China to Europe, has shot back up again. It's now back up near $10,000, which was the historic high from a month or so ago.
Well, I do believe that, you know, there has been an easing generally, but there are clearly pinch points, and there will continue to be. You know, it's not long ago since we had the Suez container ship problem. And that sent sort of paroxysms of fear through all sorts of different supply chains around the world. We've still got the semiconductor issue as regards automobiles. It's going to hit chemicals in some shape or form, clearly. So this is, you know, these issues are not going to go away quickly. And of course, we're in major lockdowns in certain parts of the world. And we, you know, unfortunately, terribly, the coronavirus pandemic continues to spread like wildfire in some nations. So therefore, you know, we're not going to see these supply chain issues go away anytime soon.
Thank you very much, Nigel, Paul and John. As ever, it's very easy to subscribe to ICIS Chemicals Podcasts. Just search for ICIS Chemicals Podcasts on any app.